You're listening to Serious Inquiries Only.
Hello and welcome to Serious Inquiries Only. This is episode number 72. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. All right, here's my agenda for today. Prior to like a week ago or maybe a little more, I had no idea. I had heard the name Joe Arpaio, but I didn't really know much about him. So my plan was to do an in-depth look at him. But after this whole thing blew up, it looks like that coverage has largely been done. So I'm not going to go too in-depth on him just at the risk of it being information you already have. But I am going to take a bit of a look at who he is and what he did and why he was pardoned, that kind of thing. And then I want to compare it to claims that people are making about people Obama pardoned. So there's some claims being made about Obama pardoned a terrorist, but it's actually worse than Arpaio. So I wanted to look at that for a minute too. Also, I'm finally going to answer the question of just where was President Barack Obama during Hurricane Katrina? Because he wasn't president then. There are actually people who are asking or saying he wasn't doing anything during Katrina when that was actually Bush who was president. So it's really weird. And there's also looks like there might be some like Russian bot influence on that. We live in a weird time, basically. I hope someday we have the answers for this. Hopefully in the future, someone's listening to me right now and is like, well, yeah, no, that was a weird time. Here's what was going on. I'll tell you, but maybe not. Things are confusing. So I want to look at that. And then I've got some voicemails during which I need to talk about a few things I got wrong on Monday's episode. I want to clarify a few things. Don't panic. Largely, I think the information on Monday's episode was great, but there are a few clarifications I need to make. And thank you for everybody who has commented and especially people who are more science and statistics oriented who are getting back to me on that. So the voicemail will be an opportunity to do that and also talk about an appearance I made on We the People Live, Josh Zepps's show. That was really fun. It was a heated debate. And now I'm hearing nonstop from white people on Twitter. So that's how you know it went well. All right. Well, with that said, let's get to the programming for today. All right, Joe Arpaio. Wow, this guy. He was elected in 1993 as the sheriff of Maricopa County in Arizona, and he took it upon himself to just be a huge hard ass regarding illegal immigration. And he went so far with it that he broke the law many, many a time, which is something you would hope that the person in charge of the law wouldn't do. So this pardon is absolutely not okay for so many reasons. There are little similarities with pardons here and there that Republicans are using to argue that, you know, more whataboutery. What about Clinton? What about Obama? What about? And it's worth looking at, and I wanted to have a good defense for that because someone challenged me about it on Facebook, and I answered, but I didn't have a detailed view of everyone that Obama pardoned, and it's difficult because he pardoned so many people. Actually, correction, he actually didn't pardon very many people. He commuted the sentences of a lot of people. He pardoned fewer people than most recent presidents. Actually, while I'm on the topic, important definition there. Pardoning and commuting are not the same thing. They're two different things. Pardoning is forgiving a crime. And look to opening arguments for more detail on this. We did an episode on pardon power. We've done a couple, I think. And actually, we are going to talk about the Arpaio pardon, but it'll be more from a legal standpoint. I just want to talk about from a politics standpoint and from a standpoint of what actually happened and putting it in perspective. But anyway, pardoning is forgiving the crime. And commuting the sentence, a commutation, is just reducing the amount of punishment. So someone has a 30-year sentence, you say, well, okay, that's enough. We're going to commute you to a 15-year sentence or something, and they will get out earlier than they otherwise would have. Put another way, and this is sort of important, a pardon wipes out the conviction, but the commutation leaves the conviction intact but it wipes some of the punishment, some or all. And there can be conditions on that too. So that's kind of what's going on there. So it's pretty big difference, I think, between pardoning someone completely and saying, look, essentially this conviction never happened because I just wiped the slate clean, versus what Obama did with so many of these drug criminals was say, all right, you've served enough time. Our drug laws are unjust. I'm letting you out now instead of 20 years from now or something like that. Even though he's still saying you committed a crime, he's not trying to wipe away the conviction. So back to Joe Arpaio, very sadistic guy. It's pretty disgusting. There are so many charges against him. There's so much. There's a newspaper. I think this is the best way to talk about it, although it's I'm not going to cover everything because it would take too long. But the Phoenix New Times is the local newspaper there, and they've been covering Arpaio for more than 20 years, and they did a tweet thread, got a lot of attention. You might have seen it, where they document a lot of his just horrendous dealings and his crimes against citizens and against suspected illegal immigrants as well. So I'm going to go over some of the highlights just to let you know how bad of a person this guy is. And I think I'll just link you this tweet thread because it has all the sources right there. It'll be easier than me trying to individually do it. And I want to give the Phoenix New Times the credit here. He ran a jail that he described as a concentration camp. I think everyone's heard that by now, but it was sort of a hot mics and situation where he described it as a concentration camp favorably. He tried to walk that back later, but the footage exists. Here, tell you what, why don't I play it? Very quick clip.
I already have a concentration camp. Andy, you gonna cover me on this too? It's called Tent City.
Oh, that's so funny. That's hilarious. Oh, yeah. Making a joke about concentration camp that is too real, all too real, barely a joke, because he set up Tent City in 1993, and it was just to extend the county jail, essentially, like to increase the room that they had there. And it was for convicted and sentenced prisoners. The thing about Arizona is it's really, really, really hot. And there'd be times when the temperature reached 118 and the temperature inside the Tent City was 145. He measured it himself proudly because he's a sadistic asshole. And then also there was another one, 110, and it got up to be 120 degrees in there. He very clearly had a mindset of if you've been convicted or even really accused of a crime, you deserve to be treated horribly, something that's unconstitutional. I mean, it's very clearly in the Constitution that there should be no cruel and unusual punishment. And there's more comparisons to a concentration camp because prisoners died there at an alarming rate, often without explanation, according to the Phoenix New Times. The best estimate, because there's no actual good records kept, is that 160 people have died in Arpaio's jails. But it's an estimate. Let me just read you a little bit from the article here because it's just disgusting. But that is an estimate because the truth is that no outside authority keeps track on how many people die from brutality, neglect, disease, bad health, or old age in Arpaio's jails. Federal Judge Neil Wake twice has ruled that medical care is so deficient in the jails as to be unconstitutional. The Department of Justice supposedly monitors conditions in the jails, but has shown little or no appetite for confronting Arpaio. I think this is an old article because that changed. What my research discovered is that people hang themselves in the sheriff's jail at a rate that dwarfs other county lockups. And many of the deaths are classified as having occurred in the county hospital or in a cell without further explanation. People die and no one asks how, no one asks why. End of quote. That was reading again from the Phoenix New Times. I think what blows me away about this is how conservatives are celebrating this. And he does this from a conservative mindset. Like he doesn't want to spend, for example, there's an article of he didn't want to spend any money on the $500 it would have taken to get one inmate who had Crohn's to get him the right pills. The resulting medical costs were like $30,000. And that's not even counting the inevitable lawsuit. This guy has been sued so many times. The taxpayers of Arizona have had to pay for this guy's brutal and disgusting record because he violates people's civil rights and then gets sued for millions oftentimes. It's just the most anti-conservative thing there could be. And by the way, that person who had Crohn's, who almost died, very nearly died, lost 4 pints of blood, horrendous, horrible, painful experience. this was not a murderer. This is not someone who raped somebody. This was someone who tried to cash a fake check. And that's the level of punishment that Arpaio thinks he deserves. I mean, this is just the most disgusting, vile, sadistic person that I it's really hard to believe, and it's hard to imagine. This one's even worse, especially just having gone through having a baby with my wife. There was a pregnant woman, and this isn't the only time that this has happened, but in one of his jails, there was a pregnant woman who was having really bad pain, more so than just pregnancy, which of course is already bad when you're in labor. And she tried to get help because she had had a kid before, and she knew that this pain wasn't right. And they wouldn't give her the help she needed, to the point where she actually lost the baby to something, a placental abruption that is normally the babies can survive the condition if they go to a hospital. But because they wouldn't allow her to, and they didn't take her pain seriously enough, she lost the baby. Really, really hard for me to read that one. I just can't imagine showing that kind of inhumanity, I guess, to a fellow human. It's really sad. And the more you look at it, the worse it gets. And you know what? Okay, Trump is awful for this. Trump is awful for pardoning this person. But you know what? You know who else is awful? The people who kept this person in office. The voters who reelected him, what, 3-4 times, finally didn't reelect him in 2016. I mean, there is plenty of blame to go around here. Let's not put this all on Trump, because people knew this was happening. This was getting reported on, and ideology and ignorance kept him in power. It's disgusting. And for anyone who hasn't looked into this, I haven't even scratched the surface of this stuff. I mean, sex crimes, where there were 400 sex crimes, in 3-year period that were reported that he did not investigate, his office did not investigate adequately or at all in times. He targeted his political opponents. And this is another thing that cost taxpayers millions of dollars, because he would target whoever was running against him or speaking out against him. He tried to get them indicted on trumped up charges, on all kinds of felony charges. Stuff, by the way, again, the taxpayers, the county specifically, had to pay millions in these lawsuits and settlements because of what he was doing. And this was in 2008 and 2010, between those years. And by the way, the attorney that Arpaio used, Andrew Thomas, the attorney that Arpaio used to try to make these trumped up cases, it was so bad that he was disbarred by a panel. And the panel also said that if this were a criminal case, we are confident that the evidence would establish this conspiracy beyond a reasonable doubt. The attorney he worked with was disbarred, and the counsel said, this is criminal. I mean, this is horrifying. And Arpaio was still reelected in 2012. Gosh, I keep wanting to try to wrap this up, but they're so egregious. Couple more examples. He actually arrested reporters from the newspaper that I've been referencing, the Phoenix New Times. He arrested them for covering him, and the newspaper won a $3.75 million settlement for that. Look at how much he's costing these poor taxpayers of this county, these idiots who elected him. Oh my gosh. All right, last one, not really the last one, by the way, but just the last one I want to cover because I want to move on. Oh man, this is the best one. He fabricated an assassination plot against himself. This was in 1999. They framed a guy. They framed a guy saying he was planning to bomb the sheriff, and it later in the trial, it was shown that it was the sheriff's money that purchased all the bomb parts, and there was an undercover officer who drove him around to buy the bomb parts. So they just made some poor guy do this, like just framed him, and he spent like 4 years in jail until finally he was cleared of all of it. And then, wouldn't you know it, he sued Arpaio, and Arpaio had to pay millions and millions. Oh, sorry, not Arpaio. The taxpayers had to pay millions and millions and millions of dollars for this absurd plot. This guy is awful. Arpaio is absolutely awful. But just read into it if you want. Just do some research. This is 5% of how awful he is, but he is awful. So let it suffice to say. Now let's get to what he was actually convicted of, or what he was actually pardoned for, just to get that detail in there. because it's important. So in 2008, this investigation into whether or not Arpaio's office was violating the civil rights of people and discriminating and utilizing racial profiling, this began. And it took 3 years. And by the way, during this, Arpaio held a press conference during which he announced that he would not cooperate with the investigation. And he didn't cooperate. He tried to delete emails. He tried to get rid of evidence, did all this stuff. After 3 years, the Department of Justice released the findings, and they said that that Arpaio oversaw the worst pattern of racial profiling in U.S. history. In U.S. history. I laugh just because of how, you know how hard that is to do? The worst in U.S. history in this day and age? I mean, I would think it would be the worst in recent years, the worst in a decade. The worst back since forever in U.S. history. Now, who knows if the Justice Department was exaggerating, but that's pretty bad. So as a result of this, the Department of Homeland Security revoked the sheriff's office authority to identify and detain illegal immigrants. So they said, like, you're so horrible with this, you're not allowed to do this anymore. You no longer, in 2011, you no longer have the authority to do this. And Arpaio just refused to stop. He just refused to stop racially profiling. And finally, after years of this, the court held him in contempt of court. In 2015, he admitted that he violated court orders. And he also, so it's a little complicated. I'm going to leave this to Andrew in tomorrow's episode because there's like a civil contempt of court and a criminal contempt of court. But long story short, the government, the U.S., was asking him to stop racially profiling, stop doing all these things. And he just refused. And this is what makes this interesting, pardon-wise, because while Trump undoubtedly has the constitutional power to pardon, and that's not disputed by anyone serious, I don't think, because pardon power is very, very broad. But in this case, he's using his constitutional pardon power to make it okay for someone to violate the Constitution, which is really interesting. Now, I don't think it means that, you know, I think it'll be just like everything else Trump does, where the only way there's ever going to be consequences is if the Republicans decide there are consequences. But it's still very, like, that's why this pardon is so weird. Now, there are a bunch of other ways this pardon is weird. First and foremost, he didn't work with the Justice Department. The Justice Department has guidelines for pardons, and he didn't follow them at all. Now, that's not unheard of. Because this happened in what was really a pretty bad pardon, something that certainly deserves scorn, and that is Bill Clinton's pardoning of Mark Rich. He was indicted in 1983 on charges of tax evasion and illegally buying oil from Iran. He was actually still a fugitive at that time, but just before leaving office, Clinton pardoned him. The reason was Rich's ex-wife was a major Democratic donor. So that's bad. That's one reason, you know, that's some Clinton corruption there, definitely. But there's a great article on 538 that kind of highlights the ways that this pardon is different and is potentially corrupt. And the interesting thing is each individual aspect has some amount of precedent, but this pardon of Arpaio is all of them together. Here, let me go through them very quickly. Pardoning someone who has violated civil rights, that's very rare. It happened in 1981. Reagan granted pardons, and this was related to what they violated the constitutional rights of anti-war radicals in the 70s. So that has happened, but not very often. Pardoning a political crony or past associate, now that has happened. Again, Clinton pardoning Mark Rich. Of course, there's Gerald Ford pardoning Nixon, but that could be looked at a different way. Also, Clinton pardoned his half-brother, Roger Clinton, who had served time for selling cocaine. Another way in which it's unique is he's granting clemency to someone whose duty is to protect the public. There's some precedent for this. George W. Bush commuted the sentences of two Border Patrol agents, this was right before he left office, who had served less than 2 months of an 8-year sentence for shooting a fleeing unarmed drug smuggler and then trying to cover it up. Bush commuted that. So there's that. There's also Obama and Chelsea Manning, which I'm going to talk about later. Granting clemency for crimes with a human toll. Again, some precedent for this. using it as a policy tool, pardoning someone who flouted the legal system. Mark Rich is the only other example for that. Issuing a pardon. This is really weird. Issuing a pardon before charges or sentencing are imposed. This is why disregarding the Justice Department's guidelines is so interesting here, because you almost never pardon someone where he still is in the middle of the court system. This is where we have to look at, what are pardons even for? And it seems as though the consensus is that the founders intended them to be a bit of a check on the justice system, and or you use them to either pardon people where you think there's a miscarriage of justice, or commuting a sentence when you think some mercy is prudent, when the laws are too harsh, that kind of thing. This, I think in Trump's mind, in his very ignorant, in the Republicans' very ignorant mind, this was some sort of miscarriage of justice that he's fixing. But as I outlined, he's being held in contempt of court for violating people's civil rights. There's no miscarriage of justice. And the weird thing is, as I said, he had not even been sentenced yet. And he still has an appeal. He still has other options. And normally, the guidelines of the Justice Department, which again, the president doesn't have to follow those, but they almost always do. And it's very rare that they don't. And usually it's in a very unpopular pardon in which they don't. But with the guidelines, there's usually like a 5-year waiting period after the conviction has happened most of the time. And it's only when all other avenues have been tried. And again, this Arpaio hasn't even been sentenced yet. So that definitely is not true. There's a good article in the Washington Post, which is saying Trump said this. Trump said he pardoned Sheriff Joe because he was convicted for doing his job. He said Sheriff Joe was convicted for doing his job. And as this Washington Post article says, the problem is that Arpaio was convicted for doing the opposite of his job. As a sworn officer of law enforcement, he violated the law and then ignored court orders designed to bring his policies in line with statutory and constitutional mandates. Two different federal judges found, respectively, that the constitutional violations committed by Arpaio's office were broad in scope, involve its highest ranking command staff, and flow into its management of internal affairs investigations, and that he willfully violated directives to correct those violations. End of quoting from that Washington Post article, which I'll link in the show notes. That puts it very well. This was not a miscarriage of justice. He was not convicted for doing his job. That's absurd. His job was to enforce the law, and he was doing the opposite of that. So that was along the lines of the pardon not being consistent with the Justice Department's regulation. So those are that many. And that, again, I was referencing that 538 article. That was all the ways that this pardon was different. And as I said, they all have a little bit of precedent, but this is all of them at once. And on top of that, Joe Arpaio is an awful human being, is objectively an awful, awful human being. Interesting note, I didn't know this, but I actually learned that Gerald Ford's pardoning of Richard Nixon was not that unpopular. Like, it wasn't popular, but it was supported by 41% and opposed by 50%. So, all told, not that unpopular. I didn't actually know that. Contrast that with some of Bill Clinton's pardons. You know, Mark Rich was supported by 13%. I don't know why anyone would support that, and opposed by 69%. There's some other ones. Scooter Libby from George W. Bush, that was supported by 19%, opposed by 66%. So it's just interesting to note that the pardon of Richard Nixon was not actually that unpopular, relatively speaking. All right, so just to sum up, Joe Arpaio is one of the worst humans currently living in the country. And he was pardoned. His pardon is absolutely unprecedented. But wait, someone might say, the last remaining couple Trump apologists might say, what about when Obama pardoned Chelsea Manning? And then he also pardoned like a terrorist, and he pardoned a bunch of drug criminals. What about that? Okay, well, what about that? Let's compare. Let's do some comparison. So looking at the pardon, and they actually weren't pardons. This is the first part that's important. Looking at the commutation of Chelsea Manning's sentence, I think it was an act of mercy that makes sense. And there's a good Slate piece on this from the time of the pardon back in January. And there are several reasons why this was possibly an act of mercy that I think was very reasonable. Her sentence was 35 years, and military prison, military justice is just far more harsh than civilian justice. And so that's one thing where commutations and pardons is kind of used to balance out sometimes what can be an imbalance in sentencing. That's certainly how Obama used it with drug crimes, which I'll get to in a minute. But this says here that if Manning had been a civilian, she probably would have been sentenced to a few years. And the reason why the sentence wouldn't have been that much is she wasn't found guilty of aiding the enemy or anything like that. She released classified documents, but the most classified ones she released were only marked secret, which is the second lowest label in the security world. And many were deemed unclassified but sensitive. So they weren't, she didn't release the most sensitive of documents. They were actually not that sensitive. And the most headline-grabbing thing, according to this article, that she leaked was this video, which was suppressed, of a U.S. helicopter attack in Baghdad that killed two Reuters photographers. And that was possibly a good bit of whistleblowing there, because that was an immoral thing that the military did that maybe it's good that we all know about. Combine that with the fact that when she was in prison, in this military prison, the first 3 years she spent there were cruel, inhuman, and degrading, according to a UN report. So she had already faced cruel, inhuman, and degrading conditions in prison. Her sentence was 35 years. She had already served 7 years, I think, would be the total. So what Obama did was say, okay, commuting the rest of your sentence, you'll get out in May 2017, which she did. And that's different than pardoning and saying you did nothing wrong. It's not saying that. It's saying, look, you served time, you know, already something that people looked at as cruel and unusual, and you don't need to serve 35 years for this. So that, you know, put that in perspective. The other pardon that apologists are using against Obama, and again, as a way of saying, what about, to try to excuse the pardoning of a disgusting racist, just to keep that in perspective, who did horrible things to people. One example that they use for Obama, again, is not a pardon. It was a commutation of a sentence. Hope I'm using the right word there. I think it's commutation. This was Oscar Lopez Rivera. This man was in this radical group back in the 80s that wanted an independent Puerto Rico. And they used, they did some bombings. They bombed some government buildings. This gentleman, Oscar Lopez Rivera, was never directly convicted of any bombings, but he was convicted of conspiracy for being a part of it. And he was serving a 70-year sentence. Now, the funny thing about this commutation is that it was actually under pressure from Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders had been pressuring Obama and had been bringing this to light because he has served 34 years in prison. And his crime was, yeah, it was certainly wrong, but he was fighting for Puerto Rican independence. It's one of those things where Clinton pardoned a lot of the people involved in the 90s, but he hadn't yet pardoned Rivera, commuted their sentences. And Obama pulled the trigger on it because he'd served a long time. He was an old man, something like 75 years old. He was also a Vietnam War hero, fought for the U.S. in Vietnam. So that's the kind of thing where it was used for showing mercy. He served a long time. He'd already served 34 years. He's an old man. It's not a crime, but he was never directly tied to the bombing. He was just involved in the organization, and the organization did the bombing. So it's the kind of thing where I'm not able to have terribly strong feelings about this. Is anybody worried that he's going to go right back and bomb some buildings at the age of 75 for Puerto Rican independence? I don't really think so. Do we have to punish people and keep them in jail until they die for this kind of thing? I don't know. I mean, I'd be open to the argument that this is the kind of thing that's so serious you shouldn't let go. But since he didn't directly kill anybody that we know of, he wasn't convicted of that. It was just conspiracy. I don't know. It seems to me like a reasonable use of mercy, but who knows? But it's tell you what, it's not. It's not the same as taking a man like Joe Arpaio, who's responsible for the death and essentially torture of thousands of inmates and pardoning him on the spot before he even was convicted and sentenced. Sorry, before he was sentenced for violating the civil rights of a bunch of people. I mean, it's not the same as that. So you can argue with it. If you think that Oscar Lopez Rivera needed to die in jail for what he did, I mean, I don't really agree. I'm not big on making people die in jail for that kind of crime 34 years ago, but I don't know. I suppose you could argue that. But now let's talk about the other 1,713 commutations of sentences. So Obama pardoned 212, which is actually not all that many relative to other presidents, and he commuted 1,715. So let's talk about the other 1,700-ish. And these had to do with drug crimes mostly. And we can't talk about all of them. There's obviously, I can't go through 1,700. But what I did find, I think this is very useful. I found the guidelines for their clemency initiative. So what they did was Obama set up a clemency initiative to say, look, if you fulfill the following requirements, you can apply, and then we will consider granting you clemency. And here's the requirement. So this is what you want to argue with if you're trying to say this is the same as Arpaio. Here's the requirements. If you are currently serving a federal sentence in prison and by operation of law likely would have received a substantially lower sentence if convicted of the same offenses today. If you're nonviolent, low-level offender without significant ties to large-scale criminal organizations, gangs, or cartels. If you've served at least 10 years of your prison sentence, at least 10 years. If you do not have a significant criminal history, if you've demonstrated good conduct in prison, and if you have no history of violence prior to or during the current term of imprisonment. So that's how to qualify, just to apply. And by the way, Obama granted 5% of the applications. So he got a ton of applications. He only granted 5% of them. That sounds, honestly, that sounds reasonable to me. I think that's a good policy. You've served 10 years, and if you were convicted today because of laws changing, you likely would have received a lower sentence. I mean, that sounds like something that should happen anyway. It sounds like if in 1990, the sentence would have been 50 years, and today it would be 2 years. I feel like that should almost automatically happen, but I guess it doesn't. So that's one use of pardon power, and I think it's a good use. So that's the comparison there. That's, if you want to compare what Obama did to what Trump is doing, there's the comparison. I think that's a very good use of clemency. I think the one of the worst comparisons, if you're trying to do a gotcha liberals thing, is to look at the Mark Rich pardon. I think that was pretty corrupt and ultimately definitely not a good thing to have done. So that's a valid, if you want to go back to 2001 when that happened, just on his way out of office. But I mean, there's George W. Bush did worse. He pardoned Scooter Libby. He pardoned the people involved in that murder, essentially. You know, this is a bad thing. I think Obama did better than basically any modern president. Yeah, I think that's pretty safe to say. Obama, as usual, as he has done in his entire presidency, did a better job on this respect of pardon power than any president certainly the last four. And the Joe Arpaio is probably the worst pardon of any of these. It's absolutely disgusting. So there you have it. I think that puts the pardon in perspective. I hope I've sort of outlined why this is so heinous, why it's awful. And really, a lot of people think this is something they should impeach Trump over. And, you know, just add that to the list. There's many things he should be impeached over. And it's just a question of if that ever happens. If we regain the House in 2018, there's a chance we could make that happen. I don't know how we would get support in the Senate, but you never know. So there you have it. It's time to check the voicemail. And of course, if you'd like to leave a message, that's 916-750-4SIO. That's 916-750-4746. Let's check out this week's messages.
Hi, Thomas. This is David in Kentucky. I was just trying to give you a call real quick to talk about, I had some thoughts about the whole splaining issue, and I'm sure you're excited to talk about it some more. Just something that occurred to me is I think that with white splaining, with mansplaining, and all that sort of concept, I think there are two different uses of the word, and you're primarily engaging in one And a lot of people that complain to you are simply engaging in the other definition and not really taking the time to think about it. This is my personal anecdotal experience, so maybe the case. But with me, I frequent several blogs, left-leaning blogs online. I'm very far to the left. It is not uncommon for me to be accused of mansplaining or whitesplaining or in others as a method of saying I'm wrong because of I'm either male or white. And it's a way of stopping the conversation. I don't really particularly pay that any mind because it's simply logically fallacious and not what I tend to think of splaining as. I tend to bias myself more towards what you're talking about when you're talking about it. But I think it's worth keeping in mind that that is a more common experience, the fallacious variety of the word, than I think you're giving it credit for. So, and again, it's not particularly a fault of yours. It's just that a lot of people are probably experiencing that online context a lot and then getting frustrated because they don't think that about your use of it in a different context. But keep up the great work. Have a good day.
Thanks, David. And this is a great chance to, again, mention I was on We the People Live, Josh Zepps' show. Check it out. Just Google it or put it into a podcasty thingy. But yeah, it's been a while since we recorded, actually. It's been quite a while. But I do remember specifically saying several times that I'm using it in this certain way and explaining how I'm using it. I think that you're right that there are a lot of people who misuse words. That's fine. A lot of people misuse safe spaces. A lot of people on both sides, by the way. And I mean, probably more people on the anti-social justice side misuse the word safe space. Does that mean that because they got the wrong idea and didn't do their research, do we then allow them to simply take over that word and paint it in a negative context and use it improperly? I don't really think people are allowed to just do that. But I think it's also unfair to say that that meaning doesn't exist. There is another meaning of these words that does exist, and we have to acknowledge that. And I do. And I think that's what's so frustrating. Here's what's frustrating about this on my end and what I would say about that We the People Live debate that happened. First off, I know from now firsthand experience, and I'm not going to like accuse you of this, David, but I do know from firsthand experience that people who are anti-social justice, as I'm seeing on my Twitter feed right now, a whole bunch of white people complaining about things I didn't say, this can be misinterpreted. So while I'll take you at your word, David, that one time, you know, or one or two, however many times someone said you were whitesplaining when you weren't or mansplaining when you weren't, there's also a lot of people who do whitesplain and mansplain and don't think they do and then would report it that way. So I can't really say either way, but I do have a lot of evidence of this happening when a bunch of white people come on my Twitter and say, oh, so white people can't have an opinion. Oh, so white people can't have an opinion over and over and over again. When I've clarified in that debate, which you can listen to, unless he edited it out or something, which may let me know if he did, that I could clarify that, no, it's not as though you aren't allowed to have an opinion. And the other thing that's so frustrating is so many people have tweeted at me, oh, using whitesplaining was an opportunity and a tactic that I used to shut down the conversation. And I've had to point out a million times that I did like a 45-minute podcast or more on Brett Weinstein and explain the entire thing and explain my reasoning and explain why I thought he was wrong in some cases and why I thought the protesters were wrong in some cases. And I called it whitesplaining in the course of that. Nowhere did I shut down conversation. Shutting down, you know what that would have looked like? Hi, welcome to Serious Inquiries Only. Brett Weinstein, whitesplained, end of episode. Play the music. Dun, 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 dun. That's what shutting down the conversation is. That's not doing an hour episode about it, during the course of which I mentioned that he's whitesplaining. So I have, sure, people are misusing the word, but then I also can report to you firsthand that a bunch of oversensitive white people are ignoring how I use the word, are saying I did things I didn't, and aren't able to focus because they're so victimized by this. So, you know, yeah, there's a lot of reactionaries on both sides who do things wrong. So in my opinion, those they kind of can cancel out more or less, and we can look at principles. And that's where I can get to the bottom line in this whitesplaining debate. And that's this. A lot of, again, white people arguing with me on Twitter right now are acting as though if they can find one logical inconsistency in their minds with the word whitesplaining, then the entire venture is meaningless. Or if they can find one way where it wouldn't be valid, then the entire venture is meaningless. And it's always along the lines of, what if Brett Weinstein were black and he did the exact same things? And as I think I answered to Josh Steps, the analogy is like, you know, a plumber or something. I mean, if a non-plumber comes and tells a plumber how to do plumbing, he's not speaking from the appropriate background and experience. Now, if a plumber comes along and happens to agree with that guy and says, yeah, you know what? I know what I'm talking about. This is, you're doing this gasket wrong or whatever, then you have to take it differently because that person has the relevant background and experience. And a lot of people are trying to tell me what Brett Weinstein, he's a biologist. He has the expertise about race. And I cannot believe how stupid that is. That's a big problem in the skeptic movement. We have imbued biologists with a very unearned sort of reverence on every single topic. I think it probably started with the hero worship of Richard Dawkins, and I can certainly tell you that I was a big fan of Richard Dawkins, less so now, but I'm still a fan of a lot of his work. I like the guy. But I think what happened was our community decided that scientists were magical wizards who know everything. And so that's, I guess, why we think Jerry Coyne knows what he's talking about when he's written some of the stupidest things in his blog. Being a biologist does not make you an expert on race. No more than being a physicist makes you an expert on everything. Like if by that logic, if you study the basic elements of and particles of our universe, then you should just know everything because that they make up everything. No, biologists know what causes race and they know what causes, our skin pigment to be different. They know, I mean, they can approach it from that way, but that tells you nothing about the relationships between people. That tells you nothing about the sociology and the history and the policy that we need to know about. I mean, it's just different fields. I mean, the economics, it touches on a lot of fields, touches on a lot of things. Not biology isn't one of them. Biology tells you nothing about race relations because the biology was the same in 1865 and in 1965, and now. The biology's been the same. That hasn't helped you anywhere along the way. Other than maybe to say, okay, we're all human. But that doesn't, I mean, congratulations. We all know we're all human. Only the most staunch racists of the 1800s thought that black people were inhuman, and maybe you can find a few horrible KKK members or something, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about policy. We're talking about disagreement among people who if you ask them, are black people are going to say, of course, and then they'll continue to engage in what end up being racist policies. So that just get that out of the way. But these people are acting like if they can find a single inconsistency with the word whitesplaining, then the whole thing is invalid. I would approach it from the other way. I would say, okay, we know that this happens all the time. Whitesplaining and mansplaining. I mean, are you going to deny that it ever happens that a white dude just pops into a conversation and tells a woman that he knows better or just explains feminism as though she's not there? Or same goes with the whitesplaining about diversity issues, about racism. I mean, are we going to pretend that never happens? Because I'll grab some guests, Alex Jules, I'll grab some feminist guests. I'll get Felicia back on. I'll give you examples, plenty of examples of this happening in the everyday lives of women and people of color. And then we can start there. So the pattern exists. The pattern of whitesplaining and mansplaining exists. Now, does it apply to absolutely everything? No. And you can home in on it. You can pare it down to where it's most effective, which I try to do. But you can't go the other way. You can't say, I found circumstances in which this term doesn't work, so therefore you're a bigot for using it, which a lot of people tell me. It's like, no, this happens all the time. It's a very real thing. So just notice where the burden of proof is there. And I think that's fascinating.
My name's Tyrone. Basically, I just got done listening to episode number 70, and I want to say I agree with you on with Sam Harrison and identity politics. I agree with your view on that. But Sam Harris, he's had this view about the black community identity politics for over a year now. He did a podcast with Glenn Lowry, a Harvard professor, and they pretty much came out saying that, you know, they really didn't think that prevalent. Also, he has a video on Black Lives Matter on YouTube. And he pretty much said that, you know, that's the worst thing to happen for blacks, Black Lives Matter, which is kind of, I don't know, left me scratching my head. He's influenced a huge following of young centrists and neoliberals on Twitter. I kind of run the same circles. And that following consists of the AIU guy that you play, Atheism is Unstoppable, who I think is he's racist. I think he's a fucking racist, to be honest. And there's also a guy named Nightmare Fuel. He's on YouTube also. They're two up-and-coming atheist centrists. I believe they got their views from Sam Harris because, you know, they mention him a lot. But, yeah, I'm kind of just wondering what you thought about that and kind of elaborate more on Sam Harris and his views with Black Lives Matter and the black community. Okay, thanks, man. Enjoy your podcast. Thanks. Bye.
Yeah, thanks to everyone who pointed out that the first time Sam Harris and the only time that he laid out, to my knowledge, a case against Black Lives Matter was in this podcast with Glenn C. Lowry like a year ago. I listened to it at the time, and I guess I didn't remember that they had specifically addressed Black Lives Matter. So I went back, I checked it out on YouTube, the clip where they talk about it. And so this is a tough one. I need to go through some things here. Sam's main criticism, it really is only criticism, was that there are police shootings that are justified. And with him on that, I agree. There are police shootings that are justified. And he lays it out. He lays out the spectrum. You know, there's going to be ones that range from the cops or murders to there was no way to avoid it. He lays it out and then he kind of talks about it. And he put Michael Brown on the side of a justified shooting. And there have been so many of these that I actually had to go back and look and remind myself what happened in that one. And honestly, I think he's right about that. When you look at the details of the case, and feel free, please do research on this before you come back at me. There were some witnesses initially who told the police that Michael Brown had his hands up when he was shot. They all recanted their testimony. They themselves too. It wasn't as though someone just decided they were wrong. They actually said, here's some quotes. They said, prosecution, you gave two statements. Were both of those statements true? Witness 22. No, I just felt like I wanted to be a part of something. I didn't see what I told the police that I saw. Here's another one. What you are saying you saw isn't forensically possible based on the evidence. Are you telling us that the only thing that's true about all your statements before this is that you saw the police officer shoot him point blank range? Witness 35, yes. And there are more. They testified that they lied under oath. They actually took back their testimony. So it's true. If you look at the details of what happened, I have no idea why, but it almost looks like Michael Brown had some sort of a death wish because he attacked the police officer, and there are multiple witnesses corroborating the officer's version of the story that he attacked the officer. The officer ran after him. And my memory was that, maybe he shot him as he was running away. That happens from time to time. There's definitely instances of that happening. And my memory might've blended that together. But what multiple witnesses corroborated with Wilson's own testimony is that he didn't shoot him running away. He ran after him. He told him to freeze. Michael Brown turned around and started charging at him, and that's when he shot him. Now, if it's your opinion that he still shouldn't have shot him when a man is charging at him after having received like several blows from that man, you know, in an altercation, I don't agree with you. I actually think that is an okay use of force. Maybe I would wish he had his taser instead, but we can argue about that. But it would be a far-fetched thing to call this a murder, certainly. It looks like it might have been a justified use of force. And Obama actually ended up backing up that conclusion. He said it from the facts, we may never know what really happened, but it looks as though this was a reasonable use of force. So I think Sam Harris was right about that one. Now, here's where he's wrong. He's using this example to say Black Lives Matter is harmful because they protested this, because they were there at the beginning and their representation of what happened was inaccurate. And I just think that's too harsh. I mean, first off, there were witnesses who said that Michael Brown had his hands up. And it's not as though it's unreasonable to believe that that could have been true. It happens all the time. There's police killings of unarmed black men all the time. There's plenty of examples. In that same month, there was a man who was shot running away. And that's shortly after that one. That was a pretty famous case. This happens all the time. So I'm not going to sit here and blame Black Lives Matter for being sensitive and protesting when another unarmed black man is shot to death. By all means, let's protest and let's get accountability. Let's make sure there's accountability. Let's make sure there's a proper investigation. And often there isn't. Often there the facts aren't like this, and there still is no conviction. I mean, the one recently where the guy was shot in the car when he had a permit to carry the weapon, Philando Castile. That one was just about as black and white as you can get. I mean, that was an unjustified shooting, in my opinion, if you look at the facts. And the officer was acquitted of all charges. I mean, just the other day, an Oklahoma police chief had to resign because it was discovered that he was a white supremacist. I mean, this stuff is real. The stats I read you the other day on why Black Lives Matter is needed is real. These police killings of unarmed black men oftentimes are unjustified. And they're a result of over-policing. Or maybe the fight in itself, you know, maybe you could argue, okay, once it elevated to that level, maybe then a shooting was justified. But oftentimes, the original stoppage was because of some sort of racial profiling or over-policing. I mean, there are a billion good reasons for Black Lives Matter to exist. And then sometimes there's things they could get wrong or individuals in their group could get wrong, you know? And I'm just not going to sit here and say that they don't deserve to exist because of that. That's just not true. And here's the other leap of logic that I think is really weird, because I think, and it might be the reason I didn't really remember this, because I remember Sam Harris talking about this a year ago and I thought, okay, sure. Yeah, there are some shootings that are justified. And maybe I just didn't really make the connection that he was seriously saying that Black Lives Matter shouldn't exist because of this. And I think that's my fault. You know, I think that was me not being sensitive enough to what Sam Harris was actually saying. I think I was doing a little bit of trying to paper over how problematic his views were there. And I apologize if I didn't call him out enough for this at the time. But going back to his recent podcast, where he said that Black Lives Matter is destructive to civil society. Notice that he just said it was because of identity politics. He said it was because of identifying around the variable of race. Well, how in the world, I mean, if we're really going to say that his critique of Black Lives Matter was most accurately expressed when he talked about the Michael Brown shooting, how is that related to identifying around the variable of race? There are plenty of white people who looked at that situation and saw that people had said Michael Brown's hands were up, and there was there, you know, it's reasonable to suspect that might be true, or at least want to know the truth. They weren't organizing around the variable of race. So how do you get from one to the other? So he's really saying that the only reason Black Lives Matter thinks certain things is because they're identifying around the variable of race. And I think that's horrible. I mean, I really, this is why it's confusing to me. He made the case in that last episode that Black Lives Matter was like by default wrong because of identity politics, not because, oh, they got the facts wrong on some shooting. That's a different thing. You know, you could get the facts right on every shooting. And then according to Sam Harris, now you would still be wrong because you're organizing around the variable of race. So this is confusing. I think it's not well thought out by Sam. I think he hasn't fleshed this out. I think he has some complaints about how Black Lives Matter has protested certain shootings when maybe they had the facts wrong. Well, okay, we can talk about that. But I'm happy to talk about that from the standpoint of Black Lives Matter is very, very much needed and justified. And let's find out where it's most appropriate to protest or something. I mean, we can talk about that. So thanks for the call, by the way, Tyrone. And that it's a sensitive thing, but I really am baffled by his complaints about Black Lives Matter, and I really hope that he addresses it at some point or has somebody on to talk about it.
Hey, Thomas, this is Stefan from Germany. I just listened to your episode in the Google Memo, and I was a little bit disappointed tonight because usually I really like your measured approach to controversial issues, but I feel here you kind of fell short of your usual standard of intellectual integrity. Because you were not really charitable at all in the interpretation of his statements and claims. And that's also what infuriated me most about the media coverage on this. I mean, I also disagree on the science with you, but that's too complicated for this message. So I'm just going to address two broad points, I guess. First one is, I think he makes it extremely clear that he talks about population differences that still have a significant overlap. So he agrees that you cannot inform much about the individual, but still observe differences at the population level. He even has like this graph on this, and I think both you and your guests misrepresented him there just to some extent. Secondly, I think he explains the lower rate of women in Google, not in leadership positions, but in general, by differences in preferences, not abilities, right? So he does not say that women in Google are less qualified than men. And I think given this explanation, you would expect them to be equally qualified. And I think the science also broadly supports this. So I think, again, here, you misrepresented him to some extent. And even if he didn't cite the best or most reliable sources to defend his claims, I think if you make a piece on this and release it, I just ask you to make sure to look even outside of sources, look at all the material that's out there, because there are many and very good ones. And I think otherwise you're going to end up with a very misleading piece in general that gives people a false impression if you just check his sources and not the debate in more general terms. But yeah, I hope this is helpful. Thank you again for creating this podcast. I think it's a tremendous job that you do. So yeah, thank you.
Hey, Stefan, thanks for the respectful feedback. I really appreciate it. I will just speak for myself in this. I think that you are right that I was a bit guilty of responding less to the literal memo itself and more to the sort of zeitgeist and the reaction around it. I think you're right that he did talk more about preference than actual like inherent ability for a computer programming job. And you're right about that. So I'm sorry if I directed my ire to the wrong target, but there were many people who were talking about innate ability and math skills and all this other stuff. And I should have specified that we were both, I think, but I'll speak for myself. I was responding more to the conversation around it. And you're right. But I do still think what he was doing as an employee to say those kind of things about, you know, I was going to say half because I was going to refer to women, but then I realized that Google is probably what, 10, 20% women at most. In fact, I'm looking at Google's, well, their self-reported numbers, and it's 20% women in tech jobs. In non-tech, it's 48%, but in leadership, it's 25% women. That's their self-reported data. But anyway, to use those stereotypes, even if you think that there's some scientific backing for it, I think it wasn't demonstrated. And you admitted yourself that he didn't have the best sources, which it's even more annoying for someone to write a memo like that, a sort of a manifesto about his fellow employees and not even have the best sources. Like, okay, if you want to say that I need to go look up the best stuff to prove someone else's point, yeah, I mean, I'm cool with trying to do the research to represent it properly. But when talking about this guy himself that you say I was kind of too hard on, you know, why doesn't he do that? Like, if he's going to write something that's saying that women are innately not as interested in tech, I mean, he'd better back that up if he's going to make those claims about women. But anyway, the biggest thing and the most obvious point that I should have made at the time that disputes, and I kind of did make, that disputes what he's saying is that the gender gap in tech is getting worse. It's getting worse. That goes against the idea that there's a biological explanation here. If it was biological, you would think it would be pretty consistent over time. But there's more going on here. Now, there's something I need to correct. I mentioned this in the beginning of the episode. Here's where it is. What I was saying, and I'll just speak for myself. I'm not going to put any words in Felicia's mouth or try to take back anything she said. I don't know. I guess she can address it on her own if she would like to. Maybe leave a voicemail or something. But for my part, there are some things I said. There was the fact that these things are not really settled science. They're not across culture. They're not really, we're not for sure that they're biological. And also, they're not even testing the very thing that we're talking about. They're testing ancillary things. Like, they're testing traits that might lead to possibly differences in programming preference, you know? So there's already so much error there. Like, we're already on a house of cards there in that the studies are not, for one thing, a lot of them can't be replicated. They're dealing with like toy preference, so that doesn't guarantee that it's going to translate into real life decisions and all that. And on top of that, here's what I said that's inaccurate. I said on top of all that, you've got these low effect sizes. And I talked about the fact that it's less than a half of a standard deviation. And some more statistics-minded people than me pointed out on my Patreon that actually that statistical difference, they took the example of a half of a standard deviation, that actually could explain quite a bit of a gender gap. And furthermore, the more selective you are, the bigger the gap will be. And that's something I was wrong about. I heard something, and I think I heard the wrong thing. And I apologize for that. I was wrong. The more selective you are when there's a small difference, the bigger the difference becomes. That's because like the more people at the top will be from the other population. If you have two populations where there's a difference, that's how that works. So Saba actually ran some numbers. So for example, if you had two populations and there's an effect size of 0.3 and you selected from the top 1%, his computer modeling, however he did this, I don't know how, says it would be 69 to 31%. So that's a pretty big gap. So that's something I was wrong about. Statistically, small differences like that could give you a large gap. Now, here's all the caveats. So this was like the third prong of all of the argument. So this could fall and the other two prongs still stand. But also, I would revise my beliefs. If we somehow had perfect data that showed us that women biologically would prefer this kind of job or be less skillful at it. But we'll go, the caller was talking about, it's just a preference thing, so we'll go with that. If we had solid evidence scientifically that biologically, like deterministically, women cared about programming less and the effect size was 0.3 and we only selected the top 1%, then I would expect a gender gap. But here's what, another thing I was wrong about is that they're selecting more than the top 1%. And actually, according to an article I'm seeing in Forbes here, there aren't enough people to fill the new computing jobs. So in 2015, there were 500,000 new computing jobs to be filled and only 40,000 new computer science graduates. So while I was wrong in how I said it, when I looked at the facts, there's actually too many jobs for tech people. And so if you're selecting from a large portion of your populations, there should be way less of a gap. And Saba, if you want to run that, if you want to run, like, say you're selecting 50% or something like that, I don't know how high the percentage actually is because we don't know what the total percentage of like interested people are, you know, so we don't have the numbers to figure that out, but we could do some guessing. And I imagine it will be way less of a gap. And the biggest evidence is that this gap is growing. So in 1995, there were 37% women in these jobs. And today it's something like 24. And so the problem that's going on, and the reason that I think this memo was still so inappropriate, was that clearly a big problem is the bro mentality in tech. And once while it may be true that a small amount of the gap is due to interest and difference in gender, I think it might be true that maybe there's a small difference there. There could be. I don't know. The problem is, I think that is accelerated because it's built a very male-centric, misogynistic culture in the tech world, and that's scaring away qualified women. That's scaring away women from being interested in these jobs, and that's a huge problem. So I wanted to correct that. Thank you, Saba, and others who pointed that out. I really appreciate that. I did admit that I don't have the strongest grasp of statistics, and I appreciate you. I'm glad people have my back, and I'm happy to correct whatever I get wrong. So, but it sounds like I was also wrong when I said they're only taking a tiny percentage. I think it's the opposite. I think there's more jobs than there are qualified applicants, it's looking like, based on this article that I'm reading here. So all that is to say, there's a lot of work that needs to be done to make tech companies more female friendly and to make tech jobs more female friendly. And that's far more pressing to me than writing a memo about how biologically girls, you know, like people more than trucks or something. I mean, that's why, to me, it seems pretty inappropriate. All right. Thank you for those great calls. There were more great calls. Keep them coming. I can't use all of them, but if you keep it short and you keep it concise, there's a good chance I will use it. Please keep them coming. Thank you for that. And I got to thank my new patrons. Thank you, Michael Glide, the number 17, Stacy, Isaac Kendrick, Anthony Magnabosco, Sohan D'Souza, Marco Rosano, Ray Ray, and Brian Escobar. Thank you guys so much for pledging to the show over at patreon.com/seriouspod. You really are making the show happen. And I've got to thank my all-time greats. And they are Matt Garrett, Peter Skelton, Steve Sigmund, Adrian Borshchov, Time Magazine's 2006 Person of the Year, Roger Metcalf, Andrew Waddington, Zabby. Zabby, thanks so much for the gift that you sent for the birth of my child, Phoebe. That was very kind of you, really. Clear as Kushner, Ian Ryan, Matthew Vernon, Ray Lev's Jenny, Robin, the Zika baby that lived, Marcel, the T and the B nostalgist, Democratic Socialism is Anti-Fascism, DSA, USA.org, and NetSecHeathen, Abeson, Beth Deitch, Sammy, Chaz Wallace, Granny Weatherwax will kick your ass, Luke Boucher, A New Lefty Blog, SinisterMarginalia.net, Jess Blake, Christopher Hammock, Scott M., Mark Rosano, Marco Rosano, Dan Griffith, Jonathan Moyer, Zika Baby's favorite new podcast, Reasonable Risk, Hunter Ash, and Michael Rops. Thank you guys so much for being my top patrons, making the show happen week in, week out. If you'd like to support the work that I am doing here, go to patreon.com/seriouspod and pledge as little as a dollar a show. Thank you guys so much. And with that said, I will see you on Monday.